We are continuing through the Gospel of Matthew, and Fabrizio did a great job covering the passage last week. Jesus is in Caesarea Philippi, and this incredible statement, "Who do you say that I am?" he says to his disciples. Peter chimes in, "You're the Christ, the Son of the living God." Jesus is like, "That's true." And he says, "I will build my church, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it." There's this stone language happening, rocks, building church on a rock, all of these things. But it's this big moment for Peter. Big declaration. And Jesus follows this up with a really challenging, difficult statement, a really series of statements that we're going to read today. And we're just going to dive right in on this. Just about 30 seconds delay here. But we're picking up in Matthew 16, starting in verse 21. This is a great passage for us. You know, we say all the time, we're here to help people find and follow Jesus. And obviously, a lot of people have different ideas of what does that even mean? What does it mean to follow Jesus? What does it mean to call him my Savior, my Lord, whatever you call him? We get a good picture of what Jesus himself says this means today. And it's hard. It says, from that time, so picking up on what we read last week, from that time, Jesus began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things from the elders and chief priests and scribes, and be killed, and on the third day be raised. So Jesus straight up tells them, this is the first of four times in the Gospel of Matthew where Jesus straight up tells his disciples, hey, this is going to happen. He tells them four times, at least that are written. Maybe it was more than that. It says here, he began to show them. He began to tell them. And the kind of sense here is this was something that he started doing. So it could have even been more than four times. Matthew only gives us four examples. And this is really interesting to remember. This isn't like a main point, but it's just something to reflect on. As you read through the Gospels, especially as you get to the end and you see the disciples' actions and reactions after Jesus' death. And nobody ever looks at another disciple and they're like, hey guys, no big deal. Remember, like, Jesus told us this was all gonna happen? No, they're all just losing their minds. It's like completely just, they forgot. And when Jesus in Matthew 28, when he's on the mountain with his disciples, and he gives the Great Commission. You know what it says immediately before he gives that Great Commission? You know, go into all authority on heaven and earth has been given to me. Go into all the world, make disciples, right? Teach people what it means to follow me. That's what he said. Immediately before that, it says, when the disciples saw him, they worshiped him, but some doubted. There were disciples there that were in the presence of the risen Jesus, and some of them there were doubting and uncertain about what was going on in that moment. Can you imagine that? So in one sense, I think that means we can kind of give ourselves a break a little bit, right? If the disciples were in that moment in the presence of the risen Jesus and they were struggling a little bit to understand what was going on, I think it's okay for us to kind of not be 100% sure with what Jesus is doing in a particular moment or situation or circumstance. If we're wrestling with a little bit of doubt or uncertainty, I think that's okay. I think that's normal. But going on, verse 22, Peter took Jesus aside. Whoa. Hey, Jesus. He took Jesus aside and began to rebuke him, saying, "Far be it from you, Lord. This shall never happen to you." Peter rebukes Jesus. This is an astonishing moment. Peter just had this is like textbook Peter, by the way. Peter just had this incredible moment, this glorious moment where he's the guy who correctly answers the who am I question that Jesus poses, right? Who do you say that I am? Peter stands up, you're the Christ, you're the Son of the living God. Jesus is like, yeah, and Peter was probably like, yeah, right? It was considered the height of dishonor for a disciple to rebuke his teacher, really any teacher who was in rabbi status, right, which Jesus was. This was not something that was okay to do. It's unbelievable to see Peter doing this. Any Jewish person reading this or hearing this would have been like, what? Even if you did disagree, you just didn't do this. And this just really gives us a good idea of just how unexpected and even to some degree unbelievable God's plan was, especially for Jewish people at the time. Jesus had just affirmed that he was the Messiah, the one who is going to deliver his people and reestablish God's reign and God's kingdom for his people. Now, Jewish people understood this not just in a spiritual way, but in a political way, in a national way. So that would mean nationally, politically, even militarily, somehow they were going to have to overcome Roman domination over Israel. So that's what they were expecting. But now Jesus says he's going to go to Jerusalem, suffer, and die. This doesn't sound like winning, right? This does not sound like the right answer. This does not sound like these two things don't sound like they're compatible. Being the Messiah and going to die in Jerusalem. They're like, Jesus, no, we need you alive. And it's like, well, he said he was going to rise too, right? But remember, the Jewish understanding of resurrection, the idea of one person rising in the middle of history, they didn't have a category for that. When Jesus tells them he's going to rise, they're probably just thinking like, yeah, Jesus, we know, we're all gonna rise. Like, all the righteous will rise at the end of time when God restores the whole world. That was something Jews believed. So that's probably why it didn't fully register to them, this idea of rising. They would have just been like, what? You know? Unless he went beyond and explained it further, it doesn't say how much more he told them. So obviously, this idea of him rising, there wasn't something about that where they were like, oh, well, good, at least there's that. No, they were like, this is not good. This is a bad plan, Jesus. At least Peter is saying this. He rebuked Jesus. Here's what Jesus says to Peter. These guys have some really interesting conversations. Jesus turned and said to Peter, get behind me, Satan. What? You are a hindrance to me, for you are not setting your mind on the things of God, but on the things of man. Okay. Get behind me, Satan. This is tricky. The word Satan, it's a Hebrew word, so Jesus kind of steps into Hebrew mode here. Satan is not actually a proper name or a title. At some point, somewhere in history, it kind of became the word that we started to use as like the actual name for the devil. But it's really just a Hebrew word that means adversary. And usually there's a definite article that comes before it, the Satan, the adversary, okay? The devil's actual name is Lucifer. That's his name, right? So Jesus wasn't actually calling Peter like Satan himself, but he was referring to him in this moment saying, what you're doing is opposed to me. You're acting like an adversary to me. And what Peter was saying is also very similar to another moment that Jesus had with the adversary, with the devil, in Matthew chapter 4. One of Satan's, right, we still use that word, one of the devil's temptations of Jesus was to, what, get all of the kingdoms of the world with no suffering. That wasn't even something the devil could offer him, but he tempts him with this idea of getting all the kingdoms of the world. All you have to do is bow to me. No suffering. So there's definitely something to that. Peter's thinking is consistent with the devil's. But now this idea of calling him a hindrance, this is the Greek word scandalon. You know what this means? In some Bible translations, they actually just write it out this way. But it's a word that means stumbling stone. That's funny. We just had this moment where Jesus says, you are Peter, right? You are a rock. And he's in the presence of this giant rock formation called the gates of hell, right? And Jesus says, on this rock, I will build my church. And the next moment, I mean, it may not have been immediately after. It could have been as they were traveling, whatever, at some point. But shortly after, Jesus calls Peter, you're a stumbling stone. That's hilarious. Jesus is a funny guy. This is a powerful moment. You're not setting your mind on the things of God, but on the things of man. So many things we could say about that. But we move on. Verse 24. Then Jesus told his disciples. He's like, all right, guys, hey, listen. If anyone would come after me, right? Come after me. Come follow me. Behind me. That was Peter's problem. He was trying to get in front of Jesus. Jesus says, come on behind me. Don't get in front of me. We say this with our kids all the time. We go out in places, and the kids are like, I'm ready to go. And we're like, okay. And there's like a street in their scars. They're like, come behind us, guys. Stay behind me. At least with me, right? Then you get to the with me phase, and come on, get behind me. Follow where I go. If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. For what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and forfeits his soul? Or what shall a man give in return for his soul? So much going on there. But this core idea here of deny yourself, take up your cross, what in the world is Jesus talking about? What does it mean to deny myself? There's a lot of ways you could take this, and you know, different people throughout church history have taken this in different ways, but this doesn't mean depriving yourself of your basic needs, right? Other than, right, you might be involved in fasting. Even so, that's not really like harming yourself. But this isn't just about depriving, it's not at all about depriving yourself of basic physical, physiological needs in any way, or harming yourself in any way. This ultimately comes down to living a selfless life. Selflessness. It means my life is not about me. Following Jesus means my life is not about me. And we're going to focus on that idea in a moment. But Jesus uses this powerful analogy as well of taking up your cross, taking up my cross. This is still kind of a phrase that comes up in even in our culture, right? Like, I'm bearing my cross. And you've probably seen pictures or depictions of the crucifixion moment of Jesus' crucifixion, right? Where he carries a cross, and you usually see the pictures. It shows like the whole cross, right? And Jesus has it like over his shoulder like this, and the straight support is going off the back, and he's kind of like this. So that's completely historically inaccurate, by the way. The way this actually happened was the straight beam would have been at the crucifixion site. That was there, that stayed there. The part that the crucified individual would be carried, they would almost always be tortured first. And then the crossbar, the name of it, there's a name of it. It's like stibulum, something like that. Don't quote me on that. But it's just the crossbar. That would either be nailed or tied, you know, the person's over their shoulders, and they would be holding it up, and that is what they would be carrying to ultimately the spot where they would be crucified. And then that crossbar would be connected to the main beam, hoisted up. That's how it would happen. But the point of this analogy is that whole process, the idea of a person carrying this cross, symbolizes some pretty harsh realities. Ultimately, all of it boils down to suffering and shame. It's intense suffering, right? Obviously, physically, mentally, emotionally, painful. The process of receiving and bearing a cross symbolizes that you're going to your death. And all along the way, you are just the object of anyone looking on. They either know what you did and there's shame involved in that, or they don't know what you did and they're like, I wonder what this guy did. They're spitting on them, throwing things at them. Doesn't even matter because they're just going to their death anyway. Suffering, shame. This would have been a shocking statement for Jesus' disciples to hear. It's like, first Jesus says he's going to suffer and be killed in Jerusalem, and Peter's like, Jesus, that's not a good plan. Now Jesus says, you also, if you want to be my disciple, this is your calling as well. Like, just imagine the gut thud that they must have been dealing with. And it's really interesting, like, it doesn't say anything about the disciples having any response to this. You can just imagine them just being completely shocked and bewildered, confused, completely uncertain about what they've gotten themselves in. Like, what in the world is happening right now? What are we doing, right? This is hard to hear. This is not what they wanted to hear. This is not what they were expecting to hear. This is crazy. Matthew doesn't give us much more of the, like, was there an after conversation? Was there some, like, on the road? Like, so Jesus, about that thing. You know? Maybe some of that happened. This is rough. We'll end with verse 27 here. For the Son of Man, Jesus kind of concludes this a little bit. For the Son of Man is going to come with his angels in the glory of the Father, and then he will repay each person according to what he's done. So following Jesus may be very difficult in this life, but it will be worth it, is what Jesus is saying. He's like, it's going to be worth it. And it's very important to read this and not read into this that you somehow earn your salvation from Jesus, right, by your behavior, by your good deeds, by whatever you do. Right, Jesus is talking to people who are already believers. And we live this way. We lay down our lives not in order to get something from him, but because we've already received everything from him, right? That's really important. But he says, whatever it costs you to follow me, it's going to be worth it. It is worth it. And this is where we often get stuck. Just hit this note in passing here. We get stuck when we live like this life is all there is. And we attach our hopes to material things or to how things are going right now. Temporary inconveniences, struggles, challenges, issues. We get stuck when our hearts and minds are wrapped around temporary material things, like this is all there is. This is it. It's not. This is just a blink of an eye compared to the bigger picture of eternity and all that we're waiting for. But we'll wrap this up with this idea. Just kind of focus on this for a minute and kind of flesh this out. Following Jesus means my life is not about me. My life is not about me. It's not about me. That's really a paradigm-shifting, life-altering reorientation for anyone to embrace, right? Moving from my life is all about me to my life is not all about me is a radical change in every aspect of your life, every decision that you make, your perspective on everything. This changes everything if we embrace it and actually live like this. Now, for many believers all over the world throughout church history, their experience of this is very literal and very real. The decision to follow Jesus, for many believers, even today, they have to really embrace this reality that they're making a decision that could lead to their death. And if not their death, to very real persecution, to exclusion from their family, to exclusion from their inheritance, to reduction or loss of material resources and blessing. All kinds of sacrifices that people still have to make to follow Jesus. Most of us will never have to come close to that kind of experience of deciding to follow Jesus. Maybe in some ways that's a blessing. Maybe in some ways it's not. I don't know. For us, though, it's a much more subtle thing, which maybe in some ways is much more dangerous and much more easy for the enemy to manipulate in our hearts and minds, right? I'm probably not going to encounter serious persecution or death for my faith, but I have to answer the question and live in light of the answer. What is the primary orientation of my life? Is it all about me, or is it not about me? And then if it's not about me, I still have to insert an answer, right? Is it all about Jesus? Or is it all, have I still made it all about something else, right? Some people, they just put all of their life into their kid becoming an NFL superstar, right? And all their hopes and dreams are tied up in something or someone still in this life. Or they put all of their hopes and dreams into a career or to some goal or to something, right? So it's almost not enough to just say it's not about me. We still have to ultimately land on the fact that it's not me, it's Jesus. But what about those kinds of things? Purpose, goals, life direction. Is it wrong to have goals? Is it wrong to have aspirations for my life? No. But again, the question is, what is my underlying motivation for these things? Am I trying to build my kingdom or God's kingdom? Am I striving for my glory or God's glory? Am I looking and just trying to go through my life and just wanting God to bless my things and all of my goals and dreams and aspirations? Or is my heart to just say, God, I'm asking for you to make me a blessing for the people around me and in my life and for your service? Whatever it is you want me to do, I'm up for it. Let's do it. Those are two very different ways of approaching goals, life direction, following Jesus. This applies to really every area of our life. We'll talk about a couple. A big one is relationships, specifically marriage. Most of us are married in the room, not everyone. But these things, in a lot of ways, apply outside of marriage. Slightly different ways, but in marriage, if it's not about me, my primary goal is to love, serve, and bless my spouse. Right? It's not to be loved and served and blessed. It's not to be completed by somebody else, right? That actually makes this a kind of like a transactional thing, which that's really dangerous in any relationship. If it's just a transaction, you scratch my back, I'll scratch your back, that's not love. That's a transaction. So my primary goal is to love, serve, and bless my spouse. Now, when two people are doing that, marriage is still hard. You're still going to have moments where it's difficult because you're never going to do that perfectly. Somebody's going to have a bad day sometime, maybe more than sometime, and it's going to be difficult. So how do I respond? How do we respond in moments of conflict or tension? This orientation of life speaks into those moments. If it's all about me, my goal is to bend my spouse into submission, to act and say the things and in the ways that satisfy me, that make me feel good, that I think they should do. You did this and it made me mad, so you need to change. Now, it could be that someone actually did something wrong, right? And there are ways to work through that, right? But also, maybe not. Maybe there's nothing actually wrong, or I'm just really making things all about me in this moment. When it's not about me, I can still be assertive. I can still address and work through conflict, but my goal, right, my underlying motivation is no longer to just get justice for myself. My goal is for us to be healthy. And not even just for our own sake, right, but in recognition of the fact that our marriage represents something beyond us, that's bigger than us. It's more important than just us. We're part of a much bigger thing. So it's not about me. It's not even about you. This is about we want to be good, but for a bigger purpose. Because we represent something way bigger. And also, when it's not about me and my spouse or anybody does something that hurts or bothers or frustrates me, I don't have to respond out of aggravation. My concern is actually not about me. It's, are you okay? That's hard. But that's the reality. Assuming the best of people, like nobody's like, 9 times out of 10, right? If you're in a situation where someone is actively, right, we got to talk about that. Let's talk about that. But in most situations in a marriage, the other person is not like trying to hurt you. There's something. Things are coming from somewhere. And we want to try to figure out what that is, and let's work on that together, right? Oh, this applies to kids, our interactions with our kids. Nothing will show you how selfish you are. If you thought marriage showed you how selfish you are, wait until you have kids, right? And you're like, woo, this is hard. All of my plans are out the window, right? It's hard. And your whole life and time and sleep, you don't sleep. You don't want to know what sleep is anymore. It's really difficult. This really comes up, you know, when you have those moments in public where a child is maybe not acting or behaving in the way that makes you look like the best parent on the planet. Right? In that moment, if it's all about you, what's your goal? Same thing, to bend your child's will into submission into such a way that it reflects the best. In that moment, you are not concerned with the, oh, what is going on in the heart of my child that I want to try to work through with them? That is the last thing on your mind, right? You're thinking, I do not have time for this right now. I do not need this in my life right now. This is not convenient for me right now. It's all about me. 100%. How are other people looking at my parenting right now? If I do this, I lose. If I do this, I lose. It's all about me in that moment. What if it wasn't? Like, how would that center me in those moments where it's just like, it's not about me? It's easier said than done. I know, but think about it. So many different areas we could talk about this, but I wanted to touch on this point. What about my personal needs, right? Because this idea of self-denial, it's not about me, selflessness, that could trail off into some really wild, crazy things, and even harmful things. Does a selfless life mean that I live as a doormat for all the people around me? You know my answer. No. It doesn't mean that. There's a very clear line between selflessness and serving, come alongside, wanting to bless and serve other people, and, you know, it's kind of like a technical term, but this idea of codependency, it's like the psychological term for this, where I need for people to be reliant on my service to them, right? And I find my identity in helping fix things for other people. And I can't be okay unless I'm pouring out myself and exhausting myself for the needs of other people. And I need that in order to feel okay about myself. That's not what we're talking about here. That's unhealthy, right? And in ministry context, it's very easy to fall into that. A lot of pastors and pastors' wives and families and people in ministry, this is how they live their life. And they justify it by saying, well, I'm serving the Lord. Right? It's like, that's really dangerous. We should do anything and everything we can to be healthy. That means sometimes we say no to something or to someone. Jesus like walked away from crowds of people to go to a desolate place to pray. Right? Do anything and everything we can to be healthy spiritually, mentally, emotionally, physically. But even with that, my pursuit of health in all of these ways, my motivation comes into play. The orientation of my heart and the reason why I do this. It's not merely for my own personal benefit. I'm not going to work out 5 hours a day, right? Just so I can get swole and look good at the beach, right? Like, that's not my primary motivation in life, is just to feel good about myself or look good for other people. I want to be healthy so that I can actually serve, so I can live my life for God's glory and be a blessing and serve the people around me. That doesn't mean I live as a doormat for people, but it does mean I can be a blessing. We could talk about ways this impacts the way we think about things at work, career, how I interact in workplace situations, in conflict, if it's all about me versus if it's not. I already talked about ministry a little bit in the work and even collaboration we do with one another, right? Again, this can sneak in. This can sneak into churches. This can sneak into things we do together. It's all about me, or if it's not, big difference. So, assignment for the week. Here's what I want us to do. Wake up every day. That's point one. You have to wake up in the morning, right? Wake up every day and just say. Whether you whisper it quietly to yourself or you shout it out loud and wake up your spouse. Just say this. It's not about me. It's not about me. And start your day, start our day. I've already been experimenting with this the last few days. You do it and see for yourself. There's something powerful about this mindset, guys. It's not about me. When you're making your breakfast, it's not about me. When you're doing the dishes, it's not about me. You're driving to work. Or you're on a train. It's not about me. You're working through another argument between your kids. Sorry, Parker. It's not about me. It is not about me. Let's work on this. Your kid is losing his or her mind in Target. Or fill in the, but it's probably Target, let's be honest. It's not about me. You're working through another argument with your spouse. Okay. It's not about me. Your spouse is losing his or her mind in Target. Right? Maybe that won't happen. Maybe it will. Yeah, you know. It's not about me. Start saying this all the time and just see what happens. And tell somebody. Talk about it. It's going to be interesting to see what people say and experience about this. Following Jesus means my life is not about me. Let's pray. Lord, we come to you this morning and we're grateful that we can trust you, even though what you are doing makes absolutely zero sense to us. When your plan is not what we would have planned. When your ways are completely foreign and unusual to how we think we would do things if we were in charge. Forgive us for our stubbornness and everything else. And God, give us the grace to really reflect on and embrace this reality, what you've called us to our life, our lives, of coming behind you and leaving our agenda, our will, our plans, our goals behind, and just going through each day looking for what is it that you are calling us to do. You did not come to be served, but to serve and to give your life as a ransom for many. So teach us what it looks like to just live that out, even in the most mundane, everyday, normal ways with the people that you've given us, the people you've placed around us, our families, our neighbors, our coworkers, our kids, our community, our brothers and sisters here. Teach us to live that way. Where our life is not all about us, and that this life is not all there is. We ask for your grace in all of that, your Spirit's leading, empowering, filling us to do this. This is not something that's natural or normal for us. What's normal for us is the complete opposite. So we need you to empower us for these things. We ask you to do that. In Jesus' name, amen.